Inspiration Move podcast. My name is Zoe, and this week I am talking to Kirsten about her 100-kilometer adventure with Ness at Oscar's Hut to Hut. Actually, we recorded this last week, so you'll hear us talking a little bit about dentists because she had to get her wisdom teeth out, and it was just one of those weeks where I had. Pretty busy, and so I'm only just now getting to put it all together, and it's just part one because we only got through her first day, which was eventful enough. So I will hope to have part two up by the end of next week also, and enjoy.
Hello. You've got it on video.
Yep. Can you switch on your video?
I'll try.
Because I'm going to try to, like, put it on YouTube.
Oh, I could have done my hair. How's that?
Awesome.
Hey.
Hello. Everything gets sorted at school?
Yes. Fucking hell. I'll tell you what. I'm a bit... I had to run back inside this morning to get the sports uniform. We'd driven 100, 200 metres down the road and realised that we didn't have the sports uniform. So I've done a UE and turned around and come back. And then we've gotten 3K down the road and realised that we didn't have our locker key. And I thought, oh, well, that's okay. There's a spare at school. And then I was sitting down to my coffee at the cafe and the school rang and said, both of his locker keys are at home. So we have to wait for an hour for that.
Hello.
Awesome.
The audio's all fine, and the way I had recorded in video was just recording me and you went in there. And I think I've changed it now to record as a split screen, so I'm just gonna hope for the best and but yeah, like I had just like a hell of a morning.
Oh, okay, maybe not.
With Piper, and it's just like, I've been doing this for 4 years. When do the tantrums about socks stop? Surely it's got to be soon. But anyway, so
I'm on Facebook. I saw a Facebook meme the other day about the going to school and the battles with socks, and who would have thought that was what parenthood was about.
Yeah, you think that like nappies are bad, and then it's just like, it's at the like Riley actually did this whole comic with cartoon cats, which is 100% inspired by Piper's distaste for wearing a uniform in the morning and her being super grumpy. And I'm like, that is hilarious, mate, and that's really creative, but don't show that to Piper because she's going to take that the wrong way. So and there's in full sort of like Japanese sort of stylized. So the happy cat has these really like bright big eyes, and then the cranky cat has these like super angry eyes. It's very good. Alrighty. You've just been out for this morning. Was it your second recovery run since you've been back? Or have there been more?
I did three runs last week, and they all felt terrible, mostly. I had the first week off, the first week directly after Oscar's off, and then did a 20-minute run last Tuesday, a half-hour run on Wednesday morning, and halfway through that my foot started hurting unexpectedly. Never hurt there before ever, so that was a bit out of the blue, and it just hurt all day, unfortunately. And then I tried to run on it again Saturday morning, giving it a few days rest, and it started to hurt in a different spot. The run still felt pretty average.
I always like it when pain moves. I feel like it's a good sign when pain moves. It's like it's moving around. That means something's happening. It's bound to get better at any time.
Absolutely. And it wasn't, because it wasn't in the same spot, it sort of gave me a little bit of hope that maybe it was just a bit of inflammation and maybe my foot strike being tired and, you know, I don't know. The next run I did was Tuesday morning. Yeah. So that was a half hour recovery run and things had started to feel a little bit better, which was fantastic. So yeah, I think I might just wipe last week. Yeah. And we'll start fresh with this week because this week feels much better to be a recovery week.
Yeah, I've had marathons like that where you have like the first run back and you think that it's been enough time and then you get like 5 minutes in and you're like, no, it's not enough time. No.
The big mistake.
Big mistake. Go home.
Yeah. It's actually, I had thought I was starting to feel a bit better towards the end of last week and then I came down with a head cold for a few days and I realised I'd pushed myself too soon last week. And then I guess it's that thing, you don't really realise how tired you are until you start feeling better.
Yeah.
Like when you've got a baby in the house and you just feel tired all the time. And so, yeah, you don't realise how tired you are until you start feeling less tired. So this week I've felt much more myself, energy level wise, and clarity in my brain and all that sort of stuff. So
it's hard when you're doing something like that and then you have to go straight back into sort of parenting and working and everything like that, and you don't necessarily, it's a bit different to, you know, like if you're able to sort of like come home and, you know, like actually take a week off. I used to get quite nostalgic whenever I'm sick, but when I didn't have kids and I could be sick before kids, and I could just like sit in front of the heater and like watch TV and like not cook for anyone and you know, like not do anything. I could go to the toilet without somebody screaming at me from the shower because they need me to bring them a brush.
Oh, it was all like that. I tried to reduce the amount of stuff that I had committed to that first week, knowing that it was mostly going to be a bit of a struggle. And there was lots of lying on the couch time, but at the same time it was just I couldn't concentrate on more than one thing at a time. It was all I could do to put food together for the children and for myself. It was all just assembly. There was no actual cooking. It was just, everything was a massive struggle. And it's not till this week where I actually can sort of feel like I can start to plan ahead and not just react to stuff, but actually start formulating some kind of proactive plan about things. It's really just that you go into survival mode and it's just whatever I can manage to get done. And the tiredness that I didn't expect. I didn't know what to expect, but I certainly didn't expect that level of fatigue to carry on for 2 weeks.
So when do you think the sort of like the seed was planted with 100 kilometers? Like, was there a moment where you kind of thought, I would like to do that, but I'm not sure if I can? Or
it was probably, hard to say, I get confused about what year it is, but you know how long ago things, it would be probably 2 years ago the seed was planted, maybe even a little bit longer. I remember thinking when Naomi Ellis signed up to do her 50k, I think it was maybe Blackall or something like that, she didn't end up doing it, but she started training for it. And I think because we did learn to run at the same time, and she sort of went to this 50K spot, and I thought, oh, 50K, now there's a distance I hadn't really considered. And I think that was when the seed was planted for the very first time. But then it wasn't till probably 2 years ago when I started paying a little bit more attention to what Joe Bailey was doing. And I think she was doing her UTA, or I had read her UTA 100K report, and I couldn't even fathom that people could run that long. that 100K thing. And at that stage, I was still trying to get my head around maybe I could do a 50K. I think I lay the blame firmly at her feet. Inspiration to go and do something like that. Yeah. Like, I just had no idea that it was even a thing, let alone whether or not it was something that I could try and do. And I guess it comes back to that you can't be what you can't see. Saying that you just, you know, you don't even know that it's a possibility, let alone something that you could aim for, unless you see other people doing it. Someone's got to plant the seed at some point.
Yeah, I mean, and it's funny, I was listening to this podcast with two men talking about women's participation in trail running, and they were kind of like talking like it's some grand mystery as to why there aren't as many women in trail running. And in the same breath, the dude is talking about how he's only home like 100 days a year and his wife looks after their kids. And it's like, well, there's your answer. You know, like, yeah, women have other stuff to do, you know, like,
you have to sit around the work, the kids, the, you know, the school run, the preschool stuff, everything else, and you know, family, spending actual time with the family on the weekend. It's overrated, but yeah, like, it's no great mystery. But there's also a lack of representation right from the beginning, and I think it's slowly starting to filter through a little bit. And I think once I had my eyes open to the fact that it was a thing that you could do, that it was a thing that I could maybe do, I started seeing it everywhere I looked, which is, you know, once you could say exactly the same thing for all sorts of aspects of running, you know, just the running itself, you know, once you start doing it and you start paying attention, you start seeing people running everywhere, you know, every drive down the street and you see people running. It's like, oh, I never realized that there were so many people in my town that, or in my city that ran at this time of the morning. So, it's sort of, I think, yeah, I started paying a lot more attention. And I think it was something that, it's hard to put into words. I had never really had a desire to see how fast I could run, but I remember having a thought about, I wonder how far I can run. I wonder how far I can, how far can my brain let me run? You know, how strong mentally can I be? And you know, physically to actually run that sort of distance. So, yeah, I guess it's more of a testing the limits and see how you go. But at the same time, I'm trying to be really sensible about it and not just go straight to the, you know, super extreme end of things. You've got to build up from somewhere. You've got to try and not hurt yourself along the way, I guess. But yeah, it's I certainly blame Joe fairly and squarely for finding myself where I am at the moment. And which is wonderful.
I guess too, with when, you know, you're looking at like how far can you go, it's just a lot more of a pleasant experience when you're on trail, as opposed to like the people who, which is amazing, but I can't ever imagine sort of like wanting to do it as a thing, like people who do like 24 hours on the track or something like that, we're just like round and round in circles.
Crazy. And there are people, you know, one of my friends, she's doing, it's actually two women I know doing it next weekend up in Canberra, the AIS, the 24 hour and 48 hour endurance events, and they run around a track for 24 hours. They do change directions. Yeah.
Dizzy.
And I guess it's good, it's a very social way to run a long way.
Yeah.
Because you're constantly going past your support crew, the other runners, and all that sort of thing. And you've got, you know, you've every 400 metres, you've got a drink of your favourite drink. You don't have to carry anything with you. You've got
you don't have the same kind of impact as on the road because you're on a trail.
Yeah.
You know.
And it's no elevation or anything like that, but I guess that brings its own difficulties in that it's very repetitive on your joints and your muscles and things. But yes, it's absolutely nothing that's crossed my mind to do that kind of thing. But yeah, I guess different strokes for different folks.
Yes.
But yeah, it's, and I guess, you know, it's well lit, it's safe, it's, you know, yeah, it's sociable. I don't know. It's not for me, I don't think, but that's, yeah, I think the sense of adventure with, that you're having an adventure when you head out for a long trail run adds to it as well. It keeps your brain occupied, keeps your brain busy, and, you know, there's always new things to look at, things to look out for.
And, you know, and the course always changes from year to year, even if you're doing the same thing, because the conditions are different and the trail is going to be slightly different. And, you know, absolutely, like the difference between running on, like, when something's really dry as opposed to when it's been really wet is very, very different.
Yeah. You might as well be running on two different trails if you're, you know, dry, compared to dry to muddy, or to, I think, can make a huge difference. So, and that's one of the things about Oscars. It worries, it worries me, I'll be honest. It stops me from racing back next year, is to think, what if the weather was bad? You know, what if that was hard enough in really awesome conditions, like we had near perfect conditions and it was hard, and yeah, that was hard enough for me. So what would it be like if it was wet, you know, if it was gale force winds, or you know, I mean, you're up in the mountains, it could be anything, it could be snowing,
and torrential rain. Those rocks could be pretty treacherous if they were slippery.
Yeah. I have visions of me tumbling down a mountain so in the rain and the mud and everything, and I just think, yeah, that was hard. Like, and it's the biggest unknown. You can control so many things, but the weather, you just, and you sign up for something now, and in 11 months time you turn up at the start line, and instead of, you know, shorts and t-shirts, people are wearing jackets and thermals and all that sort of thing. Yeah, it would just be, it can be a really lovely event, or it could be just a horrible weekend of shitty weather.
It's a risk. I'm sure people would be really interested to know, because 100 kilometres, particularly with that kind of elevation, like you're talking about, like essentially you're talking about probably like two-thirds the elevation of Everest or something like that.
What are we at? We were averaging out at about, we were under 2,000 metres elevation. I think Buller is 1870 or something, and so what's Everest is 8 kilometres, and so we were just under 2 kilometres, so yeah, quarter.
Quarter, okay.
Elevation, yes.
So... you know, you've got all of that going on, but also, you know, I think that people would be interested to know, with 100 kilometres, not only is there all of that vertical, but all of that time and all of that distance, like how does that look in your training? Because obviously it's not a distance that you're doing in training once you get over. I mean, really, once you are over sort of like half marathon distance, it's not a distance that you do in training. So
it's
different.
Yeah. And I think for me, it was about trying to build up my cardiovascular fitness. You know, I live in an area that we have rolling hills. We don't have mountains around here. So there's not a lot of opportunity to actually train on any kind of terrain that looks remotely similar to what we were going to see on race day. So it was about doing hill repetitions. It was about doing threshold runs to try and build that cardiovascular engine. And it was also about trying to get time on legs So running under fatigue. So especially in the last 2 months. So I spent 2 months basically building up that base fitness, doing threshold runs and some intervals, and then moving on to some longer, easier runs. And then in December, I did a 4-hour trail run down in Melbourne. I did that with Jen, and we did the roller coaster run course and the Dandenongs. And so we were trying to get some elevation as well as some time on feet. And then in January, I went down to do the Two Bays trail run down at Mornington, and we did which had not a huge amount of elevation, but I backed it up the following day with a 20K hike with the same elevation. So I did about 1,500 meters of elevation over 48 kilometers over the 2 days. So being able to know what it would feel like the following day to back up after a decent effort, turns out it's quite difficult. So just even to get out of bed, not so much the running part of it, but the driving that I had to do to make that happen, really fatigued me. And I guess in a way it simulated how I was going to feel after, after that first day at Oscars. And it turns out, in hindsight, it turns out it was, while it was a massive stuff around that weekend, it was quite literally the best thing I could have done, to get an idea of how my body was going to feel, after not only running nearly 30K, in the warm, in the heat, with a few hills, and then to do a 5.5 hour drive and then get up and do a 4 hour hike the next morning. It was really fatiguing. So, and then, more driving to get home. And I think I spent about 15 hours in the car over 3 days, and spent, I did, well, 4 hours of running and 4 hours of hiking in there as well. But I think, my max distance for a training run was 40 kilometres, and I did that as a hike rather than a run. I knew that by that stage, I knew that our effort at Oscars was going to be a hike, not a run. I think I had deluded myself for probably since May last year when we signed up for it. I know we signed up in June, but when Ness and I decided to do it, we were like, "Yeah, we can run that. That's fine. We can do 70K in a day." And then we started talking to a few people and reading a few blogs, and then we figured out that in fact we weren't going to be running 70 kilometers in 1 day at all. That was
And
never going.
how heavy was your pack?
I never actually weighed it. I didn't want to know how heavy it was. But I think when you take into account the fact that I had at least 1.5 liters of water, sometimes 2 liters or more of water, plus food, I would say that it was probably 7 to 8 kilos in weight. We had to carry sleeping bags and sleeping mats and things like that. So once I'd actually carried my pack at capacity, for that 4 hour hike, which I did up at Falls Creek in Victoria, I tried to run with it that day, and I realized that it was going to be difficult enough to run with it on a flat road, which had no obstacles, let alone trying to do a trail run on steep terrain or technical terrain. And I realized, as I was doing that hike, that it was going to be near impossible for us to do much running at all for Oscars. So I changed my longest run into a long hike. So I did a 7 hour 40K hike with my full pack as my last long run. But while it's the longest training run I've ever done time wise or distance wise, I don't think for 100K, I don't think you wouldn't push much past a 40 kilometre training run or a 7 hour training run. I think you start to tip over into your risk benefit. You know, you are you how much recovery you're going to need from that long effort, and are you shooting yourself in the foot recovery wise? by going longer than that. And I'd say that for most of us, you would be. So it just takes too much out of you. So, you know, I know a lot of people think that you have to do a marathon training run for a 50K, but, you know, you wouldn't need to go over a 30-kilometre run for a 50K trail run, I don't think, in training. And the same, you wouldn't go that much further for your 100K effort. I think it's more about teaching yourself to push through when you're tired. So maybe you do a double up run, you do two long runs back to back to simulate that fatigue effort.
Yeah, I mean, even with road stuff, I would much prefer, like with 50Ks around there, I think it would be so much better to do sort of build up to like 1 2-hour run and 1 3-hour run, because you just get so much more time than like super long runs that take a really long time to recover from. And like once you get over 3 hours, there's no sort of substantial adaptation benefit, and your risk of injury is so much higher. So I've always found it much better to have sort of like a medium long run, sort of like midweek, and then sort of like a longer run at the end of the week, and then you have all of that sort of simulated fatigue, but you're not like occasionally I'll see, even for like marathons, I'll see training plans where people run a marathon in training. It's like,
great.
Hey, thank you.
You're running past, you know, up to 36K in training, and the recovery, it's like, you know, if you're a fast runner, then
that's fine.
In that done under 3 hours, that's fine, but there's no great benefit. You know, speaking from experience on the slower end of the marathon spectrum, you're just more tired. Past 3 hours, 4 hours, you're just exhausted. It takes too much recovery. So I think you're better off working on your mental strength and training those legs to work under fatigue on a follow-up run, a recovery run the next day. So and I think for longer efforts, that's a much more effective way to train, is to try and do those consecutive efforts, and bank on your compound interest. Don't just and I think my biggest week was not that big. It was 60K, I think, was my longest my biggest volume training week. I had a few 50K weeks, and then my biggest one was 60K, which included my 40K hike. So there was, 20K of running and 40K of hiking. So, so it wasn't even, it's time on feet. I guess for long runs, time on feet is valuable. It's not necessarily so much how much distance you can cover in that time. No one's going to give you a medal for running 60K in 6 hours necessarily on a training run. But if you knowing that we were going to spend sort of 30 plus hours out on this trail, that for me to know that after a 7-hour hike that my body felt good, it felt tired, but it felt good. There was no niggles coming up at 6 and 7 hours effort. There was no, that gives you the mental boost to know that your body is capable of that effort. And it also gives you the knowledge of where does your brain go? Where do your emotions go during that time? How do you deal mentally with being out on a trail for that long, and the frustrations of the fact that it's not running. it was a big mental leap to sort of come at. You know, we signed up not thinking that it was a trail run and with a bit of hiking, and it turns out it was a hike with a little bit of running. You know, literally we were lucky to run 1 kilometre in the whole thing out of 101K. It was Yeah, and it was under duress. It was that 1 kilometer of running was like, you know, we've at that point we were working towards a cutoff, so we didn't have much choice. We had to hurry up as much as we could whenever we could. But yeah, there wasn't for a couple of runners, there wasn't much running happening, which was
Yeah, and I just checked your Strava things before, so like over the course of it, it had about 4,000 meters of elevation gain. So there's not going to
Yeah,
be a
we
whole.
had, yeah, it was nearly six. It was 5.6 meters, 5.6 kilometers of elevation gain and almost the same loss. So it was, I think it was slightly, I think it was maybe 5.5K of loss over the 100 kilometers, because I did miss a bit. And I think in those rocky bits that, yeah, the old GPS sometimes in the valleys and things, it
Yeah.
doesn't really pick it up 100%. But yeah, it was, I think in the first day we did 2.5K, equal loss and equal gain. And it was just, I think, excuse me, our biggest roadblock was the fact that we don't live somewhere where we can train on that sort of
Yeah.
terrain on a regular basis. So,
Yeah, you can understand why people, like you see people who are like not necessarily elite runners, but sort of like, you know, like people who where running's a really huge part of their life, move to somewhere where they
absolutely.
have access to that kind of thing because it's just so hard. You know, if you are away from that kind of thing and it's where you want to do races and where you want to train, such a huge amount out of your week to be like driving places
Oh yeah, and
to
it's
do
just not
stuff.
possible to do that all the time. I mean, you know, you've got well, certainly not for me anyway. Yeah, you know, it's I'd normally work weekends as well, so trying to fit it in around work and kids and, you know, family commitments and all that sort of stuff. It's just sometimes it was a matter of, yeah, I can get into Canberra, I can drive into Canberra, you know, an hour down the road and go and find some elevation or some stairs or something like that, or I'm just going to have to make do with what I've got
Yeah.
available to me in my town. And sometimes that means running up and down the same set of stairs 10 times in a row just to try and get some elevation in your legs, or you know, running loops of a particular trail. I, you know, just did an hour and a half run one afternoon on our local mountain bike trails, and I think I went around there about four or five, six times. It was just, you just, you know, you're retracing your steps constantly because it's the only bit of trail running that's available to you. And you know, you need to get as much time on the trail as you possibly can. It's, you know, it's like if you're training for a flat road marathon, you would spend as much time as you can, you know, getting your body used to. I mean, obviously you do hills and things, but you know, you're trying to simulate race day.
Yeah, you've got to prepare for, you know, like a lot of people sort of chase the flat, but it's pretty unrelenting. And if you're used to slight undulations, it can be actually more intimidating than you realize.
Yeah, and whereas when you get to, you know, you might have to run up a hill, but then you get to run down it, and your body gets to, you get to slightly change the muscle recruitment, and you know, you get to have a little bit of a rest on, you know, on a gentle incline, a gentle decline, and things like that. But when you're running on those flat, you know, things like Gold Coast, where it is just, yeah, it's unrelentingly flat. It's hard when you're
Yeah.
used to
I mean,
running up.
because of where I'm running at the moment, like with the light in the morning, I have to go down to Ballina to run because that's where street lights are. And I could get a headlamp, but just here with the way country roads are, it's just like there's not always a lot of shoulder to run on, and I'd be a bit nervous about it. So I just drive down the hill and do it there. And so it is like a lot of flat running. And so now that it's starting to cool down and I'm able to go out during the day around here where it's like it's not super hilly, but there's a, you know, there's a decent amount of up and down. I'm like, this is so nice. Like it's just having that sort of like even just that change in feeling from like going uphill to going downhill. And it's just, it's nice to have both, I think.
It is. Oh, it gives you variety, doesn't it?
Yeah. So,
I'm getting boring. Yeah. Yeah. It's, I think it's, you know, I don't avoid the hills, but I certainly do pick my runs. Sometimes it's like, no, I actually might drive into town. I know a nice flat spot where I can run. And I just take it easy. And then there's other times when you're trying to find the biggest hill you can to run up.
Yeah, I mean, like they had like that 12-kilometer at sort of like half pace the other day. I spent like probably about half an hour the night before on my run trying to figure out the flattest possible way that I could go for that to happen, and it worked out well. It was really fun.
I saw a person running, one of the girls that I've met through running. She lives down in Kyabram in Victoria, and it's dead flat down there. And she did like a 40k run one day, and her pacing was just clockwork. It was amazing. So consistent. And I checked her elevation, and I think she had about 50 meters of elevation over 40k. And just my 4.5k easy run, you know, that morning, my half 30 minute easy run that I'd done that morning had 50 meters of elevation in 4.5 kilometers. And I just thought, she's she was training for a race. She just did the Alps to Ocean last week, and in New Zealand, and you know, that was a 330-kilometer stage race. And yeah, she lives in a flat town, a dead flat town, and she was training for an alpine run. You know, it was and how she did it. Yeah, she built her cardiovascular engine, and she ended up coming, I don't know, fourth or fifth female or something to cross the line. It's crazy. And this is somebody who lives on a, may as well be a salt pan, you know, it's so flat where she lives. It's just crazy. So it just goes to show you, look, you don't have to have access to the terrain, but it absolutely helps.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, whatever, like even when I was doing Great Ocean Road training, we had where I was living, wasn't that far away from a hill, which is probably like a kilometre hill. And so, you know, like what I would do is sort of sprint down and then sort of like probably sort of steady state run up, and it just prepared, like oftentimes people think about the uphill but they don't think about the downhill, and my
downhill
quads were in much better shape going downhill when I got to race day, because I just had all of that conditioning from going downhill. Because people often think of running fast downhill as like cheating or something. No, you know,
it's hard. There's technique involved, and you hear a lot of elite runners, you know, saying, because like with trail running, that there's a whole, you know, the mantra, walk the hills and run the downs and the flats. And then every now and again, someone will pop up and say, actually, downhill running is where you are most likely to hurt yourself. Practice running up the hills and use your downhills to recover and learn how there's a skill, there's a technique involved in running downhill efficiently and without injuring yourself. Yeah. It's because all the brake force that you're constantly stopping and starting when you hit the ground, and you can really mash up your quads and your
often
knee.
Often like sort of like going downhill just had so many more, like I think it was that Surf Coast Trail, and there were downhills that I thought that I would be running fast down, not the case, because it's like there's sort of like loose rocks and there's roots, and I'm just like, I'm not at all confident with going fast down here. Like I can sort of run down and trust that if my legs keep moving, I won't fall. you see some people going super fast down there, and you're like, that, those are people who have trained that very, very well, because it's a lot harder than it looks.
Yeah. And it is. And when Joe and I and Rebecca were over in Chamonix last year, and Joe and I went for a run one morning, and we ran up to this beautiful little chalet on the side of the mountain and turned around and ran back down the hill that we'd been hiking up. And she just took off in front of me, and she was and I was being very cautious going down the hill. I didn't want to roll an ankle. I was, you know, not sure of my capabilities sort of getting down there, and not that it was incredibly technical or anything, it was quite steep, but we got to the bottom and we were talking about the run, and she said, yeah, that, you know, Joe said, that felt great. You know, I wasn't even pushing on that downhill. And she would have got down the bottom of the hill 5 minutes faster than I did. And she was just taking it easy. And I, you know, we were talking about it, and she said, it's practice. It is, you have to practice the downhills as much as you have to practice the uphills. You've got to practice every aspect of it. So, and when you know, and I was talking to Aaron about, you know, my coach, about how, you know, how would I train for something, a run, an event in the mountains when I live in grazing country? And he was saying, well, you either work on your legs by, you know, running up and down hills, or you work on your engine, and you just have to, you know, build that cardiovascular base. So, so for me, that was, you know, that was the option. I had to do as much as I could, and working with my personal trainer in the gym to make sure that I was engaging my glutes and working on single leg strength and all that sort of stuff. And I'll tell you what, in those last 30, 40 Ks, that's when all that strength work was showing to have paid off, that it was actually easier to walk uphill than downhill at that stage. But, you know, nothing necessarily, there wasn't any injuries sort of coming through or anything, just the fatigue on your joints. But, you know, if somebody had said, oh, would you like to take the high road or the low road at this point? And I think I would have picked the high road at any, you know, at any cost, because it was just so much easier to engage those big muscles and get up a hill than it was to try and control your descent and control your, you know, each landing, going downstairs or going down the hill and things like that. But yeah, it was just, you know, I think you just have to try and prepare yourself as best you can with what you've got available to you, don't you? You can't change your circumstances easily, most of us. So you just have to try and adapt to your environment and use it the best you can to train for the crazy shit that you sign up for. So, but yeah, it would be nice to have the opportunity to train on the terrain that, you know, like that. If that's the sort of running that I wanted to do all the time, which it's not. But if that was, yeah, if I wanted to spend my time running up and down big mountains, then yeah, I'd be having to, I think we'd have to move. You couldn't sort of continually train in a relatively flat environment and then be successful, you know, doing mountain runs and things, sky runs and things like that. But
yeah.
Beauty is that there's just so many different trails out there of varying distances in different terrain, and that, yeah, you can do rainforest trail runs or you can do mountain trail runs or, you know, whatever. But it's and it's just as beautiful to run through the canopy of trees, you know, under the canopy of a rainforest, as it is to be standing on the top of a mountain and feeling like you're almost at the top of Australia. It's the views just go for kilometres. Mm. It's amazing. So, yeah.
So what was the first day? What did that look like?
I think it was a bit of an awakening, I guess, a reality check, what we were in for. I think we had no idea what was coming our way until we actually started the event. It was really nerve-wracking to walk out the door of our accommodation on the Friday morning at half past four, knowing that if we'd forgotten anything, that was it. You know, yeah. We didn't have any support crew meeting us out on course. We had Sarah coming down and she was going to meet us at the finish line, which was wonderful. But given the nature of the course, most of the access for aid stations and checkpoints was four-wheel drive only access. Yeah. So, and it was very well supported with aid stations, so we didn't really need that, but we were worried that we were going to forget some essential part of our mandatory gear and but get penalised on course and through a random gear check or something. So it was a bit of a leap of faith to walk out the door and head down to the start line. I expected to feel a little bit out of place, to be honest, at the start line. I've seen start lines for ultra runs and they're generally full of really skinny looking sinewy kind of runners, and that's not me. That's not me. But strangely, I didn't. There was a really eclectic mix of people, and I guess given it was a run slash hike trek that invites a broader group of people to participate. It was, I think, the most fun we had on day one was in the first 3 kilometres, which was in the dark, going up to the summit of Buller and coming back down. And once we got into the tree line, we sort of just, I think we very quickly realised just how technical it was going to be. We spent the first, after that first 3K, when we got in under the tree line, we spent the next 3 hours going downhill and with our toes jammed up against the front of our shoes and, you know, trying not to trip over the fallen trees and the debris on the trail. It was all single track. It was parts where you know, there's people behind us and say, when it's clear, can we pass? And, you know, things like that. And you'd have to wait a few minutes to get to a point where it was actually safe for somebody to pass you or to actually have room to pass you. So that was about 9 kilometres. That 3 hours, we covered about 9 kilometres. And I think we lost about 1.2K worth of elevation going down that hill. It was a pretty significant hill. I think we just, I don't know. We had planned to take it easy on day one. But let's just, you know, we'll cruise through day one and then we'll really push it. We're going to kick it on day two. And we sort of, I guess we kept sort of saying this to each other, that we're going to just take it easy today and then we're going to push through day two. And I kept thinking every time Ness said that to me, and I just kept thinking to myself, there's nothing easy about what we're doing here. I couldn't have moved any faster if I tried. It was, there was one spot where we could have run, but neither of us wanted to. We just enjoyed not having to watch every single footstep that we were taking. There was a little bit of fire road there, but yeah, it was just, I think it just drove home that everything about the event was just extra. It was, you weren't just going downhill for an hour, you were going downhill for 3 hours. You weren't just walking up a hill for 2 hours, you were walking up a hill for 4 hours. You know, it was some points going up one of the hills, we were saying to each other, let's just take another 50 steps and then we'll have another rest. And we'd have a breather, have a drink, right, let's just do another 50 steps and then we'll take another breath, because there's no switchbacks involved. It was just, you start at the bottom and you just went straight up the guts to the top. And it was not, this is the easiest way to get to the top. It's just, this is the most direct route from the bottom of the mountain to the top of the mountain. So it was, and then we got to the top of one particular mountain. And we had to climb over some rocks. We had to do some rock climbing, rock scrambling to get to my it was at no point on any of the course descriptions did it mention rock climbing. There was no mention of rock climbing. And Ness and I, none of us are into rock. Neither of us are into rock climbing.
It was just a case of onwards, upwards. You know, when we had the extra pressure of all the fundraising that we'd done, and neither of us wanted to turn around and say, well, sorry, guys, we didn't do it. So, yeah, it sort of added extra pressure. And I think it was, I had very generously sort of thought to, well, I thought actually quite realistically, thought that it would probably take us about 10 hours to do the first day, which was 38K.
Yep.
And it took us 12 and a half hours. So we didn't muck around. We sort of, I think we had a 20-minute stop at one aid station for some lunch. We had a Vegemite sandwich and I changed my socks and we had a bit of a drink and something to eat. But every other aid station, we, you know, signed in, filled our water bottles, grabbed a handful of food and signed out and kept going. We had, you know, there was people there with shoes off and sitting down and packs off and lying in the grass and all this sort of stuff. And we were like, no, let's just keep moving. Why would you make it any harder to keep going than it already is? But it still took us an incredibly long time. So, you know, we finally rolled into camp at 20 past five in the afternoon. So, yeah, 12 hours and 20 minutes it took us to do this first day. And I think we realised that evening that the best way to do it is to have crew. It's definitely doable without crew, but to have somebody there who was there just to look after us would have been amazing. You know, we were incredibly tired and fatigued from concentrating, not just the physical fatigue, but the mental fatigue of watching every footstep that you take and monitoring your food and fluid input all the time and, you know, the emotional fatigue as well, I guess, of, you know, doing things that you found hard and scary. And then to have to get into camp and set your tent up and, look after yourself. It seemed like a big effort. You know, dinner was all cooked for us and everything, but, you know, all you wanted to do was sit down and relax and do nothing. And, you know, I think at one point I was wanting more dinner and I was just thought, I can't even be bothered to get up and walk over to the camp kitchen to go and get a, you know, thing of fried rice or anything. It was just too hard. Yeah. So, you know, sort of the next morning to have somebody who had packed out, who would stay to pack our tent away so that we didn't have to do it at 4 o'clock in the morning or things like that, it would have been really beneficial to have somebody there to just whose job it was just to look after us.
Yeah,
would have been wonderful. But day one was really
I don't know, by the time we rolled into camp, Ness was ready to sell all her stuff, and we were going to light a fire and burn it. I think it was just neither of us. I think it had turned out to be so much more than we expected it to be. You know, you do all the mental training and you think it's going to be hard. Of course, it's going to be hard. It's 100K. There's nearly 6Ks of elevation over the 100K. You know, yeah, it's going to be hard, but it was way harder than I had expected it to be. That's for sure. Yeah. But, and then we sat around the camp after, you know, that evening, because it was Ness's 40th birthday on day one. So I kept saying happy birthday to her during the day while we were hiking along, and we were sharing a block of chocolate at camp with some other girls that she knew, these girls, Tina and Sorrel, and there was laughs over, you know, lady chafing, you know, we were having giggles about everybody's blisters and, you know, training runs gone wrong and all this sort of stuff. It was really quite funny, and it was a lovely atmosphere. And it sort of took your mind off what was coming the next day. And it was kind of nice to know that other people had found it just as hard,
yeah,
as what we had. Like, we weren't alone in that. Yeah, it was and we'd sort of taken the opportunity. There was two ladies near our group who had done it the year before, who did it last year, and they'd come back to do it again, which in my mind takes a lot of courage to go back and face up to it again, especially one of them had some real issues with heights and rock climbing and all that sort of thing. And we were trying to suss out what was coming the next day, the alleged hairy bits that now had rope in place to help us up these rocks. And we were just thinking, holy shit, if that was, you know, if it's worse than what we did today, and if it's, you know, yeah, I think we were both made a scenario in our heads, and it caused a fair bit of anguish, you know, mental anguish over what was coming the next day. So it wasn't a lot of sleep that night. It was terrible. I felt really sorry. There was people who were coming into camp at 9 o'clock at night. You know, they'd been going since 5 in the morning, and they was just making it into Lovick's hut at 9 o'clock at night, and, you know, 4 hours after us, and they were getting a really stern talking to by the people who were managing the aid station, and about the fact that they needed to be ready to leave at 5 a.m. the next day. And if they didn't leave at 5 a.m. the next day, that there was no way that they were going to finish, that they were going to, yeah, get to the next hut, yeah, before the cutoffs the next day. And yeah, the camp was noisy, you know, there was chatter and whatnot until quite late, I thought, quite late, you know, it was 9:30. Given this, you know, campground and whatever, it's just people's, just tents and people and everything. But yeah, with 100+ people camping there, it was quite noisy. So I think if earplugs would be something to chuck in the drop bag next time. It was, and we were, I don't know, we'd gone by what was in the participants' guidebook, and we'd done our, you know, we had our tent and we had one insulated shopping bag between the two of us, and there were people there who had Eskies packed, and there were people who had big plastic tubs packed, and people who had, you know, they had 3 or 4 shopping bags, you know, insulated shopping bags for their drop bag allocation. And so we had tried to, you know, we'd minimise the amount of comfort items and things like that we had brought with us, because we were under the impression that the bag limit per person was, or per team, was going to be strictly enforced. And it wasn't. So, yeah, there was lots of things that we probably, you know, that we could have taken,
with, you know, that would have made us more comfortable. But then I guess it comes back to the fact that there was just the two of us to look after ourselves, and you know, what anything that you used that Friday night, you had to pack away before you got underway on the Saturday morning. So, yeah, it was some, I don't know, it was a wake-up call that first day. It was a real wake-up call. But, yeah, I don't know, it was some... It was nothing compared to what was coming the next day, I don't think, really. In hindsight, it was probably, it really was the easier day, because the next day turned out to be 18 hours, nearly 19 hours of hiking. So, some really technical, really technical terrain. So, yeah. So that was a whole, that might... That might have to be part two.
Part two. Do you have part to do you have to go to the dentist? What time?
I do. I've got to have my, yeah, I'm going to have to leave in a few minutes because I have to go. I have to go and have a, I have to have some lunch before I go to the dentist because I may not be able to eat for the rest of the day. Yes.
That's always my concern with the dentist, yeah, is my separation period from food, and you're having the wisdoms out, which is, is it one or two that you're getting done today?
I'll be saying goodbye to solid food for a few days, that's for sure. But, because I'm having both bottom wisdom teeth removed, I won't be able to feel the bottom half of my mouth. And then it's going to be, I expect that it's probably going to be a bit sore tonight. So I thought I'm going to have to inhale a burrito before I go to the dentist, because at least I know that'll fill me up. Or charge my batteries for the next few hours. And if I don't feel like eating dinner tonight, then, you know, if it's too sore, then I'll be fine. But, I don't know. I'm a bit nervous. I'm more nervous about what could possibly, you know, all the things that could go wrong in the recovery stage, you know, dry socket and all that sort of stuff, rather than the actual procedure. Once I've had the injections and the, you know, the local anaesthetic and everything, it's it's just uncomfortable. But
yeah,
I don't know.
They asked me because I had my four out under local, and just because one of them was really close to the nerve, so they had an oral surgeon do it, and they were like, well, as long as I'm here, I might as well do all four. And I was like, yeah, just go for it. And they like asked me, did I want to keep them? And I'm like, no, I do not want to keep them. And like, I got home and there was some, I think I hadn't realised, but there was some gauze, I guess, on where they'd sort of taken that. And I went to, like, have a smoothie and I nearly, like, choked on the, on the gauze. But the actual, like, the recovery took a while, just with the swelling and everything, and I was sore and, you know, had to, but I didn't have any complications. And, you know, like, a few weeks later, it was sort of, like, back to normal. But that was probably also the swelling was probably also from having, you know, four of them out.
Reckon that it's actually it depends on how difficult it is, how difficult the extraction is, and if there's a lot of pressure on your cheeks while they're trying to take them out, that is actually what causes a lot of the swelling in the first day or two. But she said, when she was trying to help me decide between getting one out at a time or getting both done, and she said, as long as it doesn't matter if you can't feel your tongue for a few hours and it's not going to make you gag, you'll be fine. Okay. That sounded great when I booked the appointment way back in like October last year, whenever it was, and all of a sudden March has rolled around really quickly and I'm beginning to question my judgment. But but the whole point was that I knew that I'd be resting at this time of year. I knew that I'd still be in recovery from Oscars for the rest of this month. So I figured, well, while I'm
not training for something and I'm just recovering and I've got very light running load, only the two runs this week equaling an hour. Next week I've got three runs. I'm allowed to do 2 hours in total, which is really exciting. And, you know, it's very easy for the next 3 weeks. So I thought, well, this is the perfect time to, because, you know, as a runner, you're always
100% runner. It's like, yeah, when can I do this and it's not going to impact on when I can run.
Absolutely. So that was my train of thought way back then. And yeah, I don't know, it's like anything, I guess, that rolls around really, really quickly. It seems forever away until it's 3 days away and you're just faced with the reality of past Kirsten's decision making algorithms. And yeah, quite frankly, I don't know, I question her judgment these days. So but yeah, it's anyway, that's I'm sure I'll get through it. I've had a nice big cup of coffee this morning and I'll have a burrito and then I'm down liquid lunch lane for the next few days, having temperature things, so nothing too hot, nothing too cold, nothing too tasty. Gonna be, and it's just terrible when you love food. It's, yeah, it's the thought of having to drink warm smoothie, you know, lukewarm soup and lukewarm coffee and room temperature smoothies and things like that. It doesn't really thrill me.
Doesn't do anything for you.
It's like being a toddler all over again. I need to wait till your food cools down. So yeah. Anyway. Anywho. So we might have to do another. We'll have to
part two next week, and yeah, much better to, like, at least this way with getting two done at once. This whole, yeah, very unimpressive food situation is only once.
That's what I figured. Just if I'm going to be on restricted activities and restricted diet, then I may as well just knock it on the head once. I'd rather just do it once than have to do it all over again in 3 months' time or 4 months' time. No, I don't want to make a habit of it, but that's all right. Anyway. So, yeah, so I better go.
All right, well, enjoy the burrito.
I will.
It's like Last Supper. Very fun having Kirsten on the podcast, and she'll be back next week, hopefully next week, as long as our schedules line up, to do part two. If you want to connect with her, she is at She Loves to Run on Instagram. And you can also connect with her through Run Club, which is our Operation Move Sisterhood support program, which has, it's like a private Facebook group, but there's also an app you can use where you can add in all sorts of training plans into your calendar. And there's also weekly workouts and, you know, like people there to answer your questions and all of that sort of stuff. So if you're interested in that, I'll link that up as well. And Learn to Run starts on Monday. So if you want more information about that, I'll also link that up as well. And we'll be back next week, I hope. See you then. Bye.